Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, November 20th, 2020. That's 11-20-2020. You got it? And as just about everybody who listens here knows, next Wednesday will be my final News and Comment podcast as I head into retirement. I have another last interview to share with you today. It's with my friend Reverend Billy. And if you're a New Yorker, I want you to pay special attention because he's inviting you to participate in the Black Friday action at Jeff Bezos' New York pied-à-terre. So the madness continues in the post-election contest being run by Trump and his allies as the number of allies dwindle. And I think by now everybody knows about Rudy Giuliani's menopause moment. He was sweating profusely. That led the dye in what's left of his hair to mix with the sweat and run down both sides of his face. And when I first saw a picture of this, I thought, wow, he had one of those Mission Impossible face masks on. And he was ready to, you know, pull at the seam on one side to reveal an even uglier visage. And it was as comical as the arguments that he was making. Now, it's possible that Rudy's got the Rona. He was speaking without a face mask. Attorney Sidney Powell was there with him. She didn't have a face mask. His son Andrew, who has a nepotistic appointment in the Trump White House, he was there and not wearing a mask. And the younger Giuliani today tested positive for COVID-19, says he's experiencing mild symptoms. So there is a very good potential that he was, carrying the virus and able to infect people at this news conference at the Republican National Committee yesterday. But to his daddy's performance, he continues to swing wide and big and recklessly and never lands a punch. Oh, he claims we all know about the massive fraud that happens all over the country. And as you know, I have challenged the validity of our election since 2000. Most of the rigging and game playing goes on before people actually cast a vote. And while our systems are vulnerable to hacking and manipulation, there's no doubt about it. We haven't seen any evidence of that in this election. In fact, we'll get to the Georgia recount. It's not truly a recount. It was a kind of audit. But it showed that the true count was a little bit different from the preliminary count. But it didn't change the outcome. And so Giuliani and Sidney Powell and whoever else is on this ever-shifting Trump legal team, I hope they got their cash up front. They're just desperate and doing everything they can to damage the system, to mislead the Trump Republican mob Twitter base, that this election was stolen from their dear tweeter. And a couple of writers at the Washington Post, Dan Zak and Josh Dawsey, set it up pretty well here, so let me just quote from them. It's very simple, according to Rudolph W. Giuliani and the rest of Trump's legal posse, but also very vast. China is in on it. Cuba is in on it. Antifa and George Soros are in on it. At least two presidents of Venezuela, one dead, one living, are in on it. Big tech is in on it. A web server from Germany is involved. There's always a server. Multiple major U.S. cities are in on it, as are decent American citizens who volunteer at polling precincts. Argentina's in on it, too, sort of. Chicago Mayor Richard Daley was in on it back in 1960, when, according to an unproved conspiracy theory, I think it was pretty well established, he stole the presidency for John F. Kennedy, launching an ongoing pattern of corrupt cities stuffing or scrapping ballots. The It is a massive premeditated scheme to steal the election from Donald Trump, according to Giuliani. And it also involved corralling poll watchers at great distances from the ballot county. Oh, and this was bizarre. When Rudy invoked Joe Pesci and the movie My Cousin Vinny. Rudy said it's one of my favorite law movies because he comes from Brooklyn. D's Utes, I can hear him saying it right now. About 100 journalists and hangers-on crammed into the RNC lobby there, described as a potential coronavirus incubator. And for Andrew, it proved to be true. And it was a news conference on the perverse legal strategy of Trump's failed reelection campaign, which Giuliani is trying to hustle toward a twist ending. As the former New York mayor digressed about votes that could have been cast by dead people and Mickey Mouse, Trump campaign officials were at the headquarters in nearby Roslyn, Virginia, winding down operations and closing out the budget. So as he tried to imitate Joe Pesci, Giuliani said, "How many fingers do I got up?" Giuliani was trying to analogize the claims of Republican poll watchers who said they were too far away from ballot counting to adequately observe it. 15 minutes later, as he was describing the election results as a massive fraud, black liquid began to slowly streak from each of his temples down his cheeks. It might have been perspiration liquefying his hair dye or sluicing the black polymer off his glasses. I actually think it may have been bile leaking out of his cancerous and toxic brain. Anyway, one Manhattan stylist opined that it might have been mascara that Rudy or a lady friend had applied to touch up the color of his sideburns. Now, let me acknowledge, as I get ready to retire, I can be a little bit more personal. For about 12 years, as my hair went from salt and pepper to just salt, I used to put color into my beard. There's this product called Just for Men. And it lasts about 2 weeks till the white stuff grows back and you got to put more of that goop on. And I did it because I'm bald and I already look old enough. I said, well, this is one little corner I can cut to try to not look like a dinosaur. And, you know, I've been doing a local TV show, and I think it looks better to have something colored than white. But I decided to molt during the COVID pandemic, and I no longer put any color in my hair. It's weird because there are a couple of dark streaks in my mustache and part of my beard. But I've just accepted that I'm 67 years old, and this is how I look. Giuliani's got, what, at least 10 years on me? And when you see these men in their 80s running around with darker hair than people in their 50s, who do they think they're actually kidding? Well, I don't know. So it was more of the same, where they make these broad sweeping claims and act as if they're just about to reveal the evidence that will prove all this crap. And Geraldo Rivera, the guy who opened Al Capone's tomb or vault or whatever that was to find absolutely nothing, he's an expert on nothing. He said, "What I saw with Rudy Giuliani, who I've known for decades, was bizarre. It was unfocused." And that's pretty charitable. And Chris Krebs, the guy who just got fired as the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency director because he claimed that this election was free of irregularities. He said that press conference was the most dangerous 1 hour, 45 minutes of television in American history. And possibly the craziest. So Rudy made comments like, "I know crimes, I can smell them." Well, that's not evidence, Rudy. And the idea that all of these bizarre co-conspirators were able to rig this election for Joe Biden, after, of course, the Republicans did everything they could to rig it on the front end, it's got to be a real heartbreak. Oh, and I loved that one of his companions at this news event yesterday was the disgraced Bernard Kerik, who was once Rudy's driver when Rudy was the mayor. Rudy liked him so much, he made him the police commissioner. He resigned in disgrace after it was exposed that he was using an apartment to have an affair, an apartment that was designated as a rest spot for first responders at Ground Zero. That's just kind of the slimy guy that Rudy Giuliani is. So one of the angles that was raised by Sidney Powell, who is one of Trump's newer attorneys, she, of course, has been handling the Mike Flynn case. She has a bit of a southern accent. Anyway, she posted some of her so-called evidence on Twitter Monday. It consisted of three screenshots of an affidavit she said was signed by a former military officer from Venezuela about elections there. Now, I find this fascinating because the allegation has been made for several years now that the elections in Venezuela are rigged. Nobody's ever provided any evidence of that. Maduro has won elections with two or three opponents, even as the opposition party, occasionally led by Juan Guaido, boycotted the elections and then cried foul? Well, according to Lawyer Powell, the election software company Smartmatic helped the Venezuelan government rig its elections by switching votes that leave no trail. And Smartmatic was there are parallels between Smartmatic and Dominion, but their systems are different. And Dominion is now a Canadian company. Smartmatic has some connections to Venezuela. But the two companies denied any exchange of technology. They maintain that they are competitors. Dominion bought assets from a company 3 years after Smartmatic had sold those assets. And our friend Brad Friedman from bradblog.com was the first to disclose the connections between Dominion and Smartmatic. And so suddenly, these Republicans have become evangelists for election integrity. Yeah. I mean, it's rich. It really is. So when it doesn't go your way, you blame the machines, you blame people around them. And I still haven't figured out how Argentina comes into the picture, but I'm sure it's going to be as clear as possible in very short order. A little more coverage here on the Giuliani presser. This is coming from BuzzFeed. They held a press conference where Giuliani repeated the falsehood about Wayne County, alleged a far-reaching coordinated conspiracy among Democratic officials in numerous cities to rig the election in favor of Biden, and recited other baseless allegations of widespread voter fraud that judges who have reviewed the evidence so far have rejected. Thursday's events underscored the complete disconnect between the sweeping allegations of widespread nationwide voter fraud that Trump's campaign has made to the public and how they've pursued election-related challenges in court. Giuliani spoke about allegations of fraudulent activity in Michigan. And speaking more generally, campaign senior legal advisor Jenna Ellis, she's the evangelical who was a guest on Bill Maher's show last Friday night, she said they wanted to go to court to prove our case just hours after the campaign dropped one of the few legal cases that it had left to do just that. Rudy cited affidavits from another lawsuit in Michigan that he said showed that voter fraud in the state was real, but failed to mention that a judge last week found they didn't have any credible proof of fraud in Detroit. And yesterday, Giuliani talked about allegations that hundreds of thousands of votes in Pennsylvania were counted without lawful oversight by poll watchers, days after he acknowledged under questioning from a judge that the campaign was not pursuing a fraud claim. Just poor sportsmanship, right? So Powell echoed Giuliani's unsubstantiated theory of a vast, well-funded conspiracy. And she tossed in the Clinton Foundation, George Soros, Antifa, and the Venezuelan government. Oh, and Giuliani was frequently attacking the media because, well, it works for Trump, and he figured he'd work that angle as well. So what's coming next? Rudy said it's preparing to file a lawsuit in Georgia. A little late there, dude. Might file a case in Arizona. I think that horse is out of the barn. He didn't share details about what those cases would allege. And with state election officials preparing to officially certify votes, the window for Trump to find legal pathways that would undo Biden's win, well, they are quickly closing. But I do want to acknowledge Paul Leto, who's a well-informed listener from Seattle, and has done his share of work on election integrity. He believes there is one case remaining in Pennsylvania, the one that Justice Sam Alito intervened on just before the election and said any ballots received after Election Day, set them aside, tabulate them separately. And so Paul is concerned that there remains a cause of action that could bring this before the Trump-friendly Supreme Court. Now, a new poll shows that 7 in 10 voters, including about a third of Trump's own supporters, rate his post-election conduct as fair or poor. This comes from a Pew Research Center survey released today. The same survey found that more than 6 in 10 voters rate Biden's post-election conduct as good or excellent. Among all voters, 54% rate Trump's conduct as poor, 14% say it's only fair, 18% say it's good, and 13% say it is excellent. Now, there's a separate poll published this week that 72% of Republican voters say that this election has not been fair to Trump. And I think there's a correlation with those people and the followers of Trump on Twitter, because he just keeps asserting that he won, that it's been stolen from him. 94% of Biden voters say the election was administered and run very or somewhat well, but only 21% of Trump voters agree with that. And over at the Fox News Channel, with news in air quotes, some of the staunch supporters appear to be softening their positions. Tucker Carlson told viewers last night the election is over. Laura Ingraham appeared to concede as well, striking an elegiac tone. You might not have liked Trump's tweets or sometimes his tone, but you're sure as hell going to miss his American first ethos and results. No. The Murdoch-owned Wall Street Journal's editorial board said, where's the evidence? Strong claims need strong proof, not rumors and innuendo on Twitter. So far, there's no good evidence of voting problems that would come close to Biden's lead of 73,000 in Pennsylvania or 145,000 in Michigan. And Tucker Carlson took after Sidney Powell, the Trump attorney with the Southern drawl. She never sent us any evidence despite a lot of requests, polite requests. Not a page, he said. When we kept pressing, she got angry and told us to stop contacting her. And Sean Hannity is continuing to support his president. What the hell is happening in Georgia in our country, he asked. I think he came from Georgia. He at least worked in radio in Atlanta. Why are we still finding thousands of ballots weeks after the election? Does that inspire confidence in the outcome to you? Does anybody, should anyone, ever trust this? On Tuesday, he was highlighting the news that two Republican members of that board of canvassers in Detroit had balked at certifying the results. And when they changed their vote to certify, he promised to get to the bottom of it. So it's a little schizoid over there at Fox, because the news anchors refer to Biden as the president-elect. But yesterday afternoon, they broke into regular programming to air that bizarre news conference from, with Rudy and Sidney Powell. So now to Georgia. It turns out that the Secretary of State, the embattled Brad Raffensperger, somehow somebody in his office prematurely released the news release, that the election had been certified for Joe Biden in Georgia, and that the 16 electoral votes would be reported in his favor. So then there was a retraction of the accidentally released news statement or news release, and then it was later confirmed that the information is accurate and that the former Secretary of State, now Governor Kemp, he will be following the law and certifying the Georgia count no later than 5 p.m. tomorrow. And the final vote tally is a margin of 12,284 votes for Joe Biden. And as you know, because Greg Palast had poisoned my mind that with all of the voter suppression tactics, the purging of the voter rolls in Georgia, I remain shocked that the Democrats picked it up this year. And I now have the details on the four counties where the results shifted during this not official recount, but this review, manual audit of all of the 5 million ballots that were cast in Georgia. So four out of 159 counties discovered votes that had not been reported in the first round. The counties are Douglas, Fayette, Floyd, and Walton. And what we learned, Floyd County officials discovered about 2,400 ballots that election workers neglected to rescan after a first attempt failed, and the results could not be retrieved from memory cards. In the other counties, the counting of paper ballots revealed that election workers had undercounted votes after missing memory cards, which held machine cast votes. And so the ultimate shift was about 1,200 in favor of Donald Trump. Biden picked up 1,758, Trump picked up 3,032. And I want to just list for you the shift in votes by county in this audit in Georgia, because the standard claim is that recounts don't change things by much. It's just at the margins. So in DeKalb County, the shift of votes was a gain of 560 for Biden. In Cobb County, the shift was 315 additional votes for Biden. In Daugherty County, 117 additional votes. Henry County, the same, 117. And in Bartow County, 66 additional votes for Biden. Now we'll look at the top five counties where there were gains for Trump. In Floyd County, he picked up 686. In Fulton, 345. In Gwinnett, 285. In Rockdale, 241, and in Clayton County, 145. So mistakes are made, but rarely at a scale that changes the outcome. And that's the important thing to note, as Trump may try additional recounts. And as I've pointed out, the one in Wisconsin, which is underway today, where they're only recounting Milwaukee and Dane County, the capital county, I don't see the purpose of that. They could have just sent me the $3 million and I would have told them, yeah, things shifted a little bit, but not enough to change the outcome. So Mike Pence was in Georgia today. He's campaigning for the two Republican senators who are running for re-election in the January 5th runoff. And Mike's tone is very different from the combative tone that is struck by Trump. And he recited the talking points they give him. We're going to keep fighting until every legal vote is counted. We're going to keep fighting until every illegal vote is thrown out. And whatever the outcome, we will never stop fighting to make America great again. Now, I think the right way to write that last line was, whatever the outcome, we will honor it and concede. But no, he can't say that. Now, the background here is that if the two Republicans, Perdue and Loeffler, prevail, the Republicans will maintain control of the Senate. But if both of the Democrats win, it'll give the Democrats control, presuming that Kamala Harris is the vice president who would break ties. So Pence acknowledged this possibility, of course, framing it as a threat. The Republican Senate majority could be the last line of defense for all that we've done to defend this nation, revive our economy, and preserve the God-given liberties that we hold dear. And according to the Washington Post, Pence did not mention the presidential election results in Georgia during his comments, and he often spoke in the past tense. So as we speak, it's just a little before 4 o'clock Pacific time, and there has been a meeting at the White House this afternoon, called by Trump, where he invited three of the top Republican state elected officials from Michigan to come for a little Oval Office visit. Now, I'll be eager to find out if any minds were changed. But Mike Shirkey, the Republican leader of Michigan's state Senate, before he went into the meeting, he said that it's not going to happen. He's saying he cannot be persuaded to dismiss the 157,000 vote margin that Biden holds right now in favor of a scheme to have the Republican-controlled legislature choose an alternate slate of electors who are pledged to Trump. And this would be a gross heist and abuse of power. But it does appear to be at least conceivable under the Constitution and some untested possibilities. So Democrats, I think, are appropriately on guard about this. So the meeting with Shirkey and a young member of the State House of Representatives, whose name is Chatfield. Chatfield is termed out, so Trump could offer him ambassadorship somewhere, and maybe that would change his mind. But it would take a lot of persuasion, and Trump believes in his ability to do that. But how can these people face themselves, their voters? Well, they could face Trump voters and probably come out fine. But this guy Chatfield is 32 years old. He's got his law degree and a master's degree from Liberty University. That's Jerry Falwell territory. He taught at a private Christian high school before he won election to the state house. But Chatfield tweeted before the meeting, "I'm looking forward to the meeting." But he also said earlier this week, "Nothing is more important than integrity in our election system. Every single legal vote needs to be counted. This is America. That's what we do. And let me be very clear, whoever gets the most votes will win Michigan, period. End of story. Then we move on. But, of course, Lindsey Graham said, you know, he wouldn't allow a confirmation hearing for a Supreme Court nominee in an election year, and that you could hold him to it. So I need to underscore just how petty and unprecedented Trump's behavior is. First, to make the call to the two Republican canvassers in Detroit, following which they tried to withdraw their votes to certify. They failed, but they tried. And now he reaches out to lobby members of the legislature and look for schemes that could derail the process, because he is looking for a way to get this into the House of Representatives, where Republicans control more delegations than Democrats, and Trump would presumably win. Oh, and this was buried in my stack, but another embarrassment for Team Giuliani. They made a filing in Michigan where the supporting documents included data from Minnesota. Now, both states start with M-I, right? But beyond that, they're pretty different. And it was a conservative legal website reviewing the submission that discovered this and cited that the communities that were listed in the Michigan document are located in Minnesota. So I mentioned that Wisconsin has its recount underway, and they think it may be completed by next Wednesday. I do not expect that to change a thing. And Trump is seeing some people who have political cover turn on him. Here's Lamar Alexander, who is retiring from the Senate to return to Tennessee. He said, if there's any chance whatsoever that Biden will be the next president, and it looks like he has a very good chance, the Trump administration should provide the Biden team with all transition materials, resources, and meetings necessary to ensure a smooth transition so that both sides are ready on day one. And it's sad to see a guy like Lamar Alexander. He was once a presidential candidate. He was once a moderate Republican. But he has been sipping the proverbial Kool-Aid, the poison. And you can just hear the fear in that quote. Kay Granger, who is not retiring, she's a top Republican on the House Appropriations Committee. She said she has great concerns about what Trump is doing. I think it's time to move on. Here's another guy with cover, Paul Mitchell of Michigan, retiring Republican. Wrote an op-ed in the Detroit News that Trump's continued refusal to acknowledge the election result risks corroding our democracy by literally hollowing it out. So there are no people currently in office, and all of these Republicans won re-election. Right? There were only two seats flipped in the Senate, a handful in the House, and most of the pickups were for the Republicans. So they're safe. But they are still afraid of Trump. Because even if he does somehow decide to step down, he plans to remain the bully of the Republican Party. Bob Corker, the former senator from Tennessee, he ain't afraid to poke the bear. While the president has the right to legitimate legal challenges, responsible citizens can't let the reckless actions by him and his legal team stand. Republicans have an obligation, when the subject is of such importance, to challenge demagoguery and patently false statements. Bob Corker. Man you can rely on for courageous statements when they don't matter. Well, as I was consuming a glass of orange juice and some toast this morning for breakfast, I was leafing through my San Francisco Chronicle, and I had a momentary feeling of relief. Headline reads, Judges Halt Executions of Two Inmates. Opening sentence, a federal judge in Terre Haute halted the scheduled execution Thursday of a man convicted of kidnapping and raping a 16-year-old Texas girl. The ruling was handed down just hours before Orlando Hall was scheduled to die by lethal injection. And District Judge Tanya Chutkan said that Hall's execution must be put on hold as the court weighs constitutional questions, including about the protocols for execution. But then the Supremes intervened. Not once. Not twice. I think it was three times. And ultimately, Orlando Hall was executed at 11:47 p.m. last night. And I don't know all the details of his case, but I know he's a black man who was convicted by an all-white jury in Texas. But the Supreme Court, last night, rejected three different applications to stay Hall's execution, including one that was paired with another death row prisoner whose execution is scheduled for the near future, and the only American woman on death row, Lisa Montgomery, did get a reprieve when a judge in the District of Columbia ordered her execution to be put off, probably into the new year. Another story involving the Supreme Court. Today they postponed a planned hearing into whether House Democrats have the legal right to see the secret grand jury material from St. Bob Mueller's limited hangout investigation of Russiagate. They were scheduled to hear the arguments on December 2nd, but the attorney for the House of Representatives essentially said that a new Congress will convene and President-elect Biden will be inaugurated, and they're basically pushing this over into the next term and declaring that since there is no current effort to impeach Trump, that the request may be allowed to die. And, of course, this keeps secret the behind-the-scenes operations of the Mueller investigation. And Trump has repeatedly claimed that he was going to declassify lots of information related to Russiagate, but he hasn't. And so we are left in the dark about the origins of the investigation, about the evidence that Mueller claims shows that it was Russian agents who hacked into the DNC, despite the clear sworn testimony of Sean Henry from CrowdStrike, who said, well, you know, we looked at those servers and we didn't find any evidence that anything was actually remotely removed. Exfiltrated is the word that was used. And so we may never know the truth about Russiagate. Today I'm releasing the next last interview from peterbcollins.com before I retire. I had a great conversation earlier today with Reverend Billy. Bill Tallon I met first in San Francisco in the late 1980s. He moved to New York where he created this public theater character, Reverend Billy of the Church of Stop Shopping. And in this wide-ranging conversation, you get snippets of the Reverend Billy character intermingled with heartfelt comments from Bill, who's a hell of a smart guy. He knows the details of the capitalist control of this country. He is well-schooled in the issues of climate change and climate activism. And he really, he blew me away because he weaves all this into a kind of earth-centered spirituality. He essentially says that COVID is the earth showing us who's in charge, that the extreme weather events from hurricanes to wildfires are showing us the power of earth. And I think he just offers a remarkable view of the world using street theatrics to engage people shock the opposition and make some very powerful points. So in this excerpt, Reverend Billy comments on the efforts of Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein to help others suppress the release and distribution of the documentary Planet of the Humans, produced by Michael Moore, that was released back on Earth Day in 2020.
Well, I believe that the big green thinking needs to be broken, and the NGO is now receiving hundreds of millions of dollars from Jeff Bezos from Amazon. That is an empire, a very wealthy empire. Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein recently headed up a weekend examining the investment procedures of one of the bad banks, J.P. Morgan Chase. It finances so much climate change, and you know, they weren't they were not open to people that basically disagreed with them. There's a closed, my own experience is that they are a closed society, and that Michael broke up that society and declared some of their main religious maxims to be suspect. And I applauded the thing. You know, I like Michael. I think he's got a an independent streak that is needed more in that environmental movement. Which, has the environmental movement succeeded? Not at all. You know, and now they're accepting large amounts of money from the dirtiest corporation in the United States, or the dirtiest retail corporation in the United States, which is Amazon. They're accepting that money. They're saying, yeah, we are corrupt. So they are locked into the corporations that they are supposed to be opposing. Some of them, it was discovered by Naomi Klein, that there was investment directly into fossil fuels to make profits by these big NGOs. So Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein would say that I'm generalizing about the environmental movement, talking the way I'm talking. But we need to be free of that movement to really be radical.
That's Reverend Billy in an excerpt from our in-depth last interview. It'll be posted today at peterbcollins.com and all of our regular outlets. The paywall is gone, no subscription required. So I hope that you'll find time over the weekend to spend an hour listening to Reverend Billy, because he's got a lot to say. And here's my latest acknowledgement from a listener. This is from Canada. From, I believe I would pronounce this, Haider Ibrahim, H-A-I-D-E-R. He writes, "Dear Peter, I'm not a regular subscriber to your website. However, I'm a regular listener to your free daily news and comment podcast. Sad to hear that you're retiring. I appreciate your work and find it very informative and balanced. I'm not sure if I qualify to be on your alert list. Anybody does. Come on, Haider, I'm going to put you right there with your email. However, I will be on the lookout for anything new on your website and hope that you would suggest other news and comment podcasts that you can recommend. I wish you all the best on your retirement and hope to hear from you for years to come. Happy trails." Well, thank you, Haider. I really appreciate that. And I am compiling a list from listeners because, frankly, in the past few years, I have not had much time to listen to the podcasts of other people. So I am putting together a master list of all the suggestions that have come in, and I'll either post those on the website or include them in a podcast before I sign off. Kevin Gostola is one of those bright young reporters who I have promoted here on this podcast. I really respect his work. He gave us a great recap of the Julian Assange extradition hearing that he covered in detail back in September and early October. And he is also well-respected among other independent media outlets. So this gets a little confusing because Kevin has his own media platform called Shadowproof. But he wrote an article for the Gray Zone Project that was in turn picked up by Joe Lauria at consortiumnews.com, and that's where I got this today. And as I've told you, because I'm on my way out, I am not going to spend the time to learn all the details about Biden administration appointees, but you should. So I'm linking to this piece where he takes a look at what he calls war profiteers, chicken hawks, and consultants who are at the top of the list. And you know how this works. You volunteer to be on the transition team, and then you expect that out of that will come some sort of a job in the administration. And Kevin is correct that the transition team is just heavily populated by corporate consultants, lobbyists, war profiteers, national security hawks, and Democratic insiders going back to the Obama and Bill Clinton campaigns. Here's today's COVID-19 update. I want to thank Linda Lewis for all of the effort that she has put in on a daily basis to help me compile our coverage of the whole pandemic. Oh, and I just looked at my email here, and Linda has updated us that Donald Trump Jr. has tested positive for COVID. Try to restrain your elation, will you? And from Linda, here are the latest grisly numbers attributed to the pandemic. 57.3 million confirmed cases worldwide, with 1.368 million deaths linked to COVID. In the United States, we're closing in on 12 million cases. It's 11.8 right now. And that number has been going up so rapidly. Yesterday, we set a new record for the daily new case count at 187,000. And 2,015 Americans were reported to die from COVID or COVID-related causes, bringing the total death count to 253,458 Americans. And here in California, we contributed 13,000 of those newly reported COVID cases yesterday. Our hospitals are filling up, but they're not at an alarming level so far. Not everywhere. Los Angeles is having a bigger surge than the rest of the state. But Governor Newsom, who is still trying to explain that $450 dinner that he went to at the French Laundry, he did pick up the tab for himself and the first partner. But he has issued a statewide order for a curfew from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. And I should know this, but I can't actually remember back in March and April if we had a nighttime curfew here in California. But as I look at this now, I think that this is just a way to install a lockdown without calling it a lockdown. And there is a different array of businesses allowed to be open, and the restrictions are not identical to what we had in the spring. But I think the impact is pretty much the same. And as we hit Thanksgiving, we are just inviting my stepson and his roommate. We usually have a larger contingent. And I think it is the wise thing to do, to keep it in the family and the immediate family at that. And to Linda's report, a Tyson Foods manager at a Waterloo, Iowa pork processing plant organized a pool, a cash buy-in winner-take-all betting pool for supervisors and managers to wager how many of their employees would test positive for COVID-19. And now a wrongful death lawsuit in federal court in Iowa has been filed by the family of Isidro Fernandez, a Tyson worker who died from COVID-19 on April 26. The suit alleges that employees were required to work long hours in cramped conditions despite the risk. It says the company failed to provide protective equipment, other precautions early on in the pandemic. There are more than 1,000 employees who got infected at the Waterloo plant alone. And as you'll recall, back in March, there were efforts to try to indemnify the meatpacking houses So what Trump did was issue an executive order to designate meat plants as critical infrastructure. And it basically forced these workers to show up every day, regardless of the risk. The Waterloo plant is the company's largest pork plant in the U.S. They have about 2,800 workers. They process almost 20,000 hogs a day. And Fernandez was one of at least five Waterloo plant employees who have died from the virus. Well, where did this come from? Is it really the Wuhan flu? All available evidence indicates that the coronavirus may have first been identified in the central Chinese city of Wuhan, but Chinese experts are saying it didn't start there. This first quote is from Zheng Guang, former chief epidemiologist at the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Quote, Wuhan was where the coronavirus was first detected, but not where it originated. Now, the present leader of the epidemiology department at the Chinese CDC is Wu Zunyu. He made a similar comment last week, saying the pathogen could have come into the country in imports of frozen food or meat products. They're saying that, as we reported the other day, that unrelated studies show that the coronavirus was circulating among asymptomatic individuals in Italy as early as September of last year. I personally don't find this definitive. It may be true, it may not. And it looks like I'm going to be ending this podcast before we ever have any solid indication of where this originated, whether it was accidentally or intentionally released from a bioweapons lab. And as you know, I include China and the United States as suspects in a lab-based virus that ended up being released into the general population one way or another. The World Health Organization is now recommending against using the antiviral drug remdesivir in hospitalized patients, regardless of how ill they happen to be. The drug is authorized by the U.S. FDA for COVID-19 and was among the many drugs given to Trump when he went to Walter Reed. So, according to a report in The Guardian, there's no evidence that the remdesivir drug works. The WHO guidelines said that COVID patients may be better off without it. There was a trial called Solidarity in several countries. It allocated patients randomly to several drugs, including remdesivir, found that those who took it were no more likely to survive severe COVID than those who did not. The other issues, well, it's made by Gilead here in the Bay Area, and everything they do is really pricey. Also, the drug has to be delivered intravenously, and the new update published in the British Medical Journal concluded that most patients would not prefer intravenous treatment with remdesivir, given the low certainty evidence. Any beneficial effects of the drug, if they do exist, are likely to be small, and the possibility of important harm remains. This was based on a study of 7,000 adults admitted to hospitals for COVID-19. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, who I guess is going to return to his role as the foreclosure king when he is leaving the Trump administration, he defended his decision not to extend critical emergency lending facilities beyond the end of the year. He said, Congress trusted us with this money and we're going to follow the law. He denied that politics are at play in his decision, and he wouldn't acknowledge whether Biden will be taking office next year and appointing a new Treasury Secretary. He said, whether it's myself or somebody else, these can be reactivated. When this, referring to the election, is certified, when the transition is certified, of course we will work with whoever is the appropriate people to work with. The mangled syntax is his own. And David Dayan, who is a very skilled writer and I think a great observer of the American scene, writing at the American Prospect. He said the CARES Act's Federal Reserve lending facilities, which I've lovingly called the money cannon, created effectively a giant bank with up to $4.5 trillion in lending capacity. Just the pre-positioning of those resources has been enough to keep investors satisfied that they wouldn't be allowed to lose money during the pandemic, and it's the money that I've been talking about that props up Wall Street. And Dan continues, there were pretty strong hints that Republicans were disinterested in continuing the money cannon after it technically expires at the end of the year. That deadline could be extended, but Treasury would have to agree to the terms. And yesterday, Mnuchin pulled the plug. On December 31st, the corporate credit facilities, along with the Main Street Lending Program and Municipal Liquidity Facility, will end. That's $195 billion in Treasury funds that could support close to $2 trillion in lending. And here's where it gets interesting. The other roughly $250 billion that Treasury could devote to Fed programs was never even set up. Mnuchin even asked for the $70 billion Treasury had already given to the Fed as part of the lending facilities, saying it's unlikely to be needed. A final quote from Dan, the money cannon has not been employed to much useful purpose. And I just don't believe, he says, a Biden Treasury would suddenly prod it in that direction either. The money cannon has one use, if only rhetorically. By being decommissioned, the government can get to the work of aiding the real economy through the final rough patch of the pandemic. And, of course, there is no movement on new legislation for bailout money from Washington to the states, renewal of the unemployment extension, and the $1,200 nowhere in the offing at this point. It appears nothing will happen until the new Congress convenes. Stanford University's Faculty Senate voted overwhelmingly yesterday to condemn Scott Atlas for his actions as an advisor to President Trump. 85% of the Faculty Senate approved this, saying that he promotes a view of COVID-19 that contradicts medical science, that is anathema to our community, our values, and our belief that we should use knowledge for good. The resolution also alleged that Atlas has discouraged the use of masks and other public health measures, misrepresented knowledge of the pandemic, endangered citizens and public officials, showed disdain for established medical knowledge, and damaged Stanford's reputation. But it stopped short of calling for Atlas's removal from the Hoover Institution, the conservative think tank at Stanford. And we've got a whole wave in the Republican super spreader category today. Senator Rick Scott of Florida, he's got the Rona, and he is experiencing very mild symptoms, he said, but he's going to stay at his home in Naples, Florida. I mentioned Andrew Giuliani, and there's also Anthony. I now believe he pronounces his name Tata. He is the senior civilian Pentagon official who was installed last week, and he tested positive after a visit from the Lithuanian defense minister. He will isolate at home for 14 days, but I'm sure he can zoom in if there is a need for him to advise on some action against Iran, and we'll talk about that in a moment. A new projection shows that based on the surge that we're seeing in cases and hospitalizations, that an additional 26,000 to 48,000 people could be lost in the next 3 weeks alone. And the CDC pinpointed weekly averages that add up to almost 40,000 deaths in the 4 weeks covered by this new forecast. Mike Pence held a news conference yesterday to talk about COVID with the task force arrayed behind him like wallpaper. And I love BuzzFeed's headline, "Coronavirus is surging across the U.S., so Mike Pence held a useless briefing." And it was. He offered thoughts and prayers and hope and blue sky. He once again said that this is going to go away very soon. He promised that a vaccine is due imminently. And there is one difference from Trump. He does express some compassion for the losses of people to COVID in the United States this year. Also, there's a new report that nursing homes will once again bear the brunt of this new surge in COVID cases. More than 90,000 of the nation's long-term care residents have died in this pandemic that has pushed staffs to the limit. Interviews with dozens of people across the country reveal swelling numbers of less clear-cut deaths that doctors believe have been fueled not by neglect, but by the complications of the whole process, and that staff can sometimes be distracted. They also attribute it to a mental state that the elderly plunge into despair. And on some death certificates, that is reflected as failure to thrive. A nursing home expert who analyzed data from the country's 15,000 facilities for the Associated Press estimates that for every two COVID-19 victims in long-term care, there is another who died prematurely of other causes. Those excess deaths beyond the normal rate of fatalities could total more than 40,000 since March. And these extra deaths are roughly 15% more than you would expect in a normal year. And the Washington Post takes a look at the neighboring communities in Maryland and Virginia. And they are very concerned about a potential spike in fatalities at nursing homes and adult residential facilities. In Virginia, 200 staff, 380 residents have contracted the virus just since the beginning of November. In Maryland, new weekly infections among residents and staff at long-term care facilities have increased by a factor of 10 since the start of October. And Maryland's largest nursing home, called the Hebrew Home of Greater Washington, with just under 600 beds, is among five facilities in Montgomery County that have reported significant jumps in new infections. Seniors and prisoners are the ones who have been cared for the least in this pandemic in the United States. Well, just before I got ready to record the podcast, I got an email and a link to a new article by Tom Rees. Tom Rees is a Jesuit priest who's the former editor of the national Catholic magazine called America, and he was fired from that job under direct instructions from Pope Benedict. They made him meet a bishop at the airport who told him that the Pope had ordered him fired. And it's because of Tom Rees's fearless reporting. And I know Tom a little bit and took him sailing on the bay with a few other Padres one time. And he is a devout Catholic. He supports the creed. But he's not blind to the errors of the clerical leadership. And in his latest report, it opens this way. The discussion of the Vatican report on former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick by the U.S. bishops at their annual fall meeting was sad but predictable. Sad because the bishops failed to communicate that they understood the report's implications. Predictable in that some bishops defended Pope John Paul II against the report's finding that the pontiff shared culpability in the McCarrick case. The tone of the meeting was set by Archbishop Christophe Pierre, the papal nuncio, who did not even mention McCarrick's name in his address to the bishops. The president of the Conference of Bishops, Archbishop Jose Gomez of L.A., did better in introducing the discussion by saying it shows that the tragic outcome was not the result of a single failure, but rather resulted from multiple failures across many years. Well, Tom Rees is more polite about this. But the shameless cover-up of the long-running priest pedophilia scandal in the Catholic Church, it cannot be rationalized. And these leaders fail to take their own responsibility for the cover-ups and their efforts to minimize the role of now Saint John Paul II. And in a previous report, Rees offered that he should not have been canonized so quickly. Now, that was a big mistake. And just a couple of more stories here today. Iran is warning that if Trump decides to launch any kind of an attack on Iran or its interests, it could set off a full-fledged war in the Middle East. An advisor to the Supreme Leader went public and he said, "We don't welcome a crisis. We don't welcome war. We are not after starting a war, but we're not after negotiations for the sake of negotiations either, and they will not tolerate U.S. military action." And finally, today I mentioned the decisions made by voters in various states to legalize marijuana for adult/recreational use and for medical use in a handful of states this year. We know that Oregon voted to decriminalize all drugs, at least in small amounts, and to legalize psilocybin. Well, Oregon is not alone. They are providing some leadership. State Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco is planning to introduce legislation to decriminalize psychedelics, and he stated the war on drugs has been an abject failure. And in New Jersey, where voters legalized adult use of marijuana, the legislature is struggling over the enabling legislation and an amendment to legalize or at least decriminalize psychedelic mushrooms has successfully been attached to the marijuana legalization, which takes effect on January 1st. Now, I'll tell you that as a young man, I experimented with psychedelics. I liked acid better than mushrooms. The mushrooms always gave me kind of a stomach ache. But I believe that every stable person should experiment with psychedelics. The trips I took were really colorful and interesting. They opened my mind in ways that are hard to describe. And now, I know a young man who is a medical doctor, a psychiatrist, who is working to develop psychedelics as a medication to help with PTSD and other mental issues. And I'm glad to see that we have progressive legislators in Oregon, California, and New Jersey who are willing to end the war on drugs and replace it with sane policies. Thanks for listening to one of my last daily news and comment podcasts. The last one's coming up next Wednesday. You'll find this on YouTube. I remain Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.